men tailing him. The locals and tourists were a definite danger. He assumed his face had been on the news in Europe as well as the States, though he himself had not watched any television in the past week. With an abundance of caution and a desire to avoid running into a do-gooding waiter with a black belt, he adjusted his watch cap lower on his forehead and made a turn up a quiet street. John walked down the middle of the cobblestoned alleyway as it rose and turned to the left. His tail followed, still 25 yards back and on his right. He found himself in the Heumarkt, another open area full of people walking under umbrellas and electric lights, and he turned back to the north. All along, he scanned reflections, judging the disposition of the men behind him whenever he could get a glimpse of them. He was beginning to think that maybe these guys were not waiting on backup before arresting him, though they had made no move to close their distance just yet. He strolled through the Altmarkt, still heading north and parallel to the Rhine a few blocks away on his right. A quick glance in a traffic mirror on a blind street corner showed him that one of his followers had dropped out of the hunt, but the other had closed even more. This man was not 15 yards behind him now. Picking his way through the pedestrians, John began to worry. There were two men who could right now be moving into position ahead of him, ready to try to snag him at the very next corner. He liked his chances in any one-on-one encounter, but the proximity of civilians and cops could easily allow any situation to grow unmanageable. Clark picked up his pace, found himself passing a beer museum and a covered courtyard full of singing Germans, and he turned again to the right, moving now along the bank of the river. He thought about stopping, turning, and confronting the man who had closed to within 30 feet. There was no way this guy was going to take Clark in on his own, but any altercation in front of a crowd would just about ensure that someone would notice him, recognize him, and call for the police. The man behind him was threatening suddenly with his overt proximity, his unknown intentions, and his power to draw unwanted attention to the American fugitive. John turned right again at Fishmark, away from the crowds and into a dimly lit alley. There was a quick left in front of it, also dark and quiet. The sign said Auf dem Rottenberg, and John picked up the pace as he made the turn. The second man, the one who had dropped off surveillance, stood in front of him in the dark. A pistol was low in his right hand.
Monsieur Clark, please come quietly so that you do not get hurt.
John stopped, 20 feet from the man with the gun. He heard the man behind him stop in the alley as well. The American nodded, took one step forward, then spun on his shoes and ran through the back door of a pizza parlor, leaving his pursuers in the alleyway. John was not fast. Speed, he knew, was a young man's game. But he leveraged his ears in the field with each and every footfall, looking to make a quick turn here, to duck into a shadow there. He moved straight through the kitchen of the Croatian-run pizza restaurant, knocking pans and cans and cooks into the path of the men who were entering the back door behind him. He darted into the narrow dining room, pushed past the customers lined up to order their pies, knocking several of them down to the floor in order to slow the men in pursuit. In the street in front of the pizza shop, he did not turn either left or right. Instead, he crossed the street in a sprint and ran into the open door of a post-World War II apartment building. He was not sure if the chasers had seen him enter, but he ran up the stairs in the entryway, taking the steps three at a time, wheezing and grunting with the effort. The building was 4 stories tall, and it was connected to other buildings on either side. Clark thought about going all the way to the roof and trying to put space between himself and those chasing him by moving along the tops of the other buildings, just like he and his mates had done in Paris. But when he got to the 3rd floor, he heard noise above, a large group in the stairwell on the 4th floor heading his way. They sounded like they may have been just a group of young people on their way to a night on the town or a party. By their high voices and laughter, they did not sound like a snatch team from the FBI. But Clark was alone now, and he did not want to rush into a group of people who could ID him or tell the men on his tail which way he was heading. Clark left the stairwell, ran up a hallway, and saw a window at the far end. Outside, under dim electric lights, he could see a fire escape. He charged to the window, half exhausted and nearly out of breath, and pulled it open. In seconds, he was back out in the rain. The fire escape rattled and creaked with his movements, but it seemed like it would hold for his descent of the flights to the alleyway. He had just turned away from the window, grabbed the railing to head to the first set of rickety stairs down, when a man appeared coming up. Clark hadn't heard him climbing with all the noise Clark himself had made coming out of the window onto the fire escape. "No!" John exclaimed as the man, the same man he had seen watching him in the train station at the ticket kiosk, drew a silver automatic pistol and tried to level it at his prey. But the men were too close to each other on the steep and wet iron steps, and Clark kicked the gun out of the lower man's hand. The weapon flew over the side of the fire escape, and the man slipped back, down two steps to the landing just a few feet below Clark. The two men stared at each other silently for a second. John had his gun on his hip, but he did not go for it. He was not going to shoot an FBI agent, or a French detective, or a CIA officer, or a German cop. Whoever this man was, Clark had no plans to kill him. But when the man reached inside his raincoat, Clark launched down toward him. He had to close the distance before another weapon came out. Luc Patin spooked when Clark knocked his weapon away. He reached for a knife he kept in his scabbard on a neck chain under his shirt. He tore the blade free and slashed through the air at the American. John saw the motion, brought his arm up, and knocked away the blow, but took a slashing cut to the back of his hand. He cried out in pain, then he fired out his right hand, palm up and out, and he connected under the chin of the French private detective. Luc Patin's head snapped back with the punch to the jaw, and he reeled backward and then slipped, his hips hitting the low railing behind him hard, and he tumbled backward off the fire escape. His feet flew into the air as he fell. Clark leapt forward to catch his attacker by his coat, but the rain shower and the slick blood on his left hand caused him to lose hold as soon as he grabbed it, and the Frenchman fell, three stories down to the cobblestones. His head hit with a sound like a baseball bat striking a melon. Fuck, thought Clark. He had not meant to kill him, but he would have to worry about that later. Now he stumbled off the fire escape at the second floor by forcing open a thick wooden door to a kitchen apartment. He found a roll of paper towels, wrapped his hand in them as he stepped back into the hallway, and then raced downstairs and back out onto the street. 3 minutes later, he walked past the entrance to a subway, and then he hurried back to it. As he headed down the stairs, he chanced a glance behind. He saw two pursuers, men in raincoats running together through the rain across an intersection 25 meters behind. A Peugeot swerved and honked in their wake. It did not appear to Clark that the men had spotted him, but it did appear that they'd gotten word that their colleague was dead. John bought a ticket and rushed to the platform of the next train. He held his breath to keep from hyperventilating. Play cool. Stay calm. He stood near the edge by the track, waiting with a dozen others for the next train. John could not believe his luck. Somehow he had managed to make it down the steps without being seen by his pursuers, and as he struggled to fill his aching lungs with oxygen, he checked again to make sure he had not been followed. No. He could get on a train to anywhere and then make his way to safety. Well, relative safety. He felt the cool breeze from the tunnel on his left, indicating the impending arrival of the train. He stepped to the edge of the platform so he could be the first one through the doors. A final check to the stairs on his left. Clear. He absent-mindedly looked over his right shoulder as the train came out of the tunnel on his left. They were there. Two men. New guys, but definitely from the same crew. They approached him with hard faces. He knew he had made it easy for them. On the edge of the track, they needed only a little shove, and he would be gone. If they weren't planning on killing him before, he had little doubt that the death of their colleague would change their mission, no matter their original orders. He turned away from them and faced the tracks. The train was 50 feet away and closing fast, from his left to his right. John leapt off the edge of the platform, down the 4 feet to the tracks. The others on the platform screamed in shock. John crossed the rails right in front of the speeding U-Bahn. A black chain-link fence separated the eastbound line from the westbound, and he had to get over this before the train passed. He leapt onto the fence, pulled himself up with a bloody hand and an arm still aching from a month-old gunshot wound. Then he kicked his legs over the fence as the train behind him screeched and wailed. The first car struck his right foot, and his heel felt like it had been smacked with a ball bat, and Clark spun off the top of the fence, falling to his hands and knees next to the other track. Like a deer in the headlights, he looked up to face another train, farther away, but barreling down on him from the west. He could hear screams from the platform next to him. He rose and leapt forward, posting on his injured ankle to do so, and made it to the edge of the platform without touching any of the track's rails. He tried to heave himself up on the concrete before the train came, but the muscles in his arms faltered. He dropped back down, his body spent. Clark turned and looked at the train that would kill him.
Achtung!
Two young men in soccer jerseys came to his rescue. They knelt at the edge of the platform and scrambled to grab his collar and yank him up and over the edge. They were big and young and a hell of a lot stronger than Clark, His worn-out arms tried to help, but they just hung by his sides. 3 seconds later, the train filled the space his body had just vacated. John lay on his back on the cold concrete, both hands holding his aching ankle. The men shouted and slapped him roughly on his shoulder. John picked up the word for old man. One of them laughed and he helped Clark up, patted him again on the shoulder. An old woman pointed her umbrella angrily at his face as she chastised him. Someone else called him an Arschloch, asshole. John struggled to put weight on his injured foot, then nodded with a smile at the men who had saved him, and he tottered into the train that had almost crushed him. Inside, he collapsed on a bench. No one else on the platform followed. The train moved, and he looked through the window toward the eastbound platform. His two pursuers were still there, watching him escape from their grasp. 53. The White House press corps assembled in the briefing room quickly. An announcement was made that the president would be making a short statement. Within 5 minutes, a blink of an eye for those accustomed to waiting on Kielty, the president stepped into the briefing room and up to the microphone.
I have just spoken with officials of both the State Department and the Justice Department. I am told that, well, with a reasonable degree of certainty, that the fugitive John Clark has been implicated in the murder last night at around 10 p.m. local time in Cologne, Germany, of a French businessman. I don't have all the details on this just yet. I am sure Attorney General Brannigan's office will have more on this as it develops. This event underscores how important it is that we get this individual into custody. I took a bit of heat from many of my political opponents, many in the Ryan camp, who accused me of only going after Mr. Clark because of the Ryan pardons and his relationship with Jack Ryan. Well, now you see that this is not politics at all. This is life and death. I am sorry that my vindication for the decision I made concerning John Clark has come at such a high cost. Mr. Clark has fled the United States, but I want to assure everyone, including our friends in Germany and all over the world, that we will not rest until Mr. Clark is back in U.S. custody. We will continue to work with our able partners in Germany, in Europe, wherever he goes, and we will find him, no matter what rock he chooses to hide under. A reporter from MSNBC shouted over his colleagues, Mr. President, are you at all worried that there's a time limit on this manhunt? In other words, that if you do not win next week and you fail to catch Clark before your term ends, President Ryan will end the manhunt? Kielty had begun stepping away from the microphone, but he returned to it now. I am going to win the election on Tuesday. That said, whatever support Jack Ryan has, he has not been entrusted by the American people to determine the guilt or innocence of individuals. He tried that before when he gave this murderer a pardon, and, well, look where we are now. That is a job for our Department of Justice, our courts. Mr. Clark is a killer, a murderer. I can only imagine what there is still to learn about Clark's history, his crimes. Kielty's face reddened slightly. So to you all in the media, I would like to say that if Jack Ryan tries to sweep this man's past and present crimes under the rug, well, you are the Fourth Estate. You have a responsibility to keep that from happening. Kielty turned away from the press and left the briefing room without taking another question. 1 hour later, Jack Ryan Sr. made his own statement in the driveway of his home in Baltimore. His wife Kathy stood by his side.
I don't have any of the details or the specifics of the charges against John Clark. I don't know what happened in Cologne, and I certainly do not know if Mr. Clark was involved. But I have known John Clark long enough to know that if he did, in fact, kill Mr. Patton, then Mr. Patton posed a real threat to John Clark.
A reporter for CNN asked, Are you saying Luc Patton deserved to die?
I am saying John Clark does not make mistakes. Now, if President Kielty wants to go after a Medal of Honor winner, put him on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, well, I can't stop him from doing that. But I can promise everyone that John deserves more than this country could ever give him as repayment for his services. And he certainly does not deserve the treatment he's getting from this president.
The CNN reporter interjected.
It sounds like you're saying your friend is above the law. No, I'm not saying that. He is not above the law. But he is above this political theater disguised as law. This is disgusting. My wife has quite correctly admonished me in the past for getting a look on my face like I've just bitten a lemon when Ed Kielty is mentioned. I've tried to hide it as best I can. But right now, I want everyone to see how repulsed I am by what is going on relative to John Clark.
As soon as Ryan re-entered the house through the kitchen, Arnie Van Dam turned to face him.
Jesus, Jack. What I said was true, Arnie.
I believe you, I do, but how is that going to play?
I don't give a shit how it plays. I'm not going to mince words on this. We've got an American hero out there being hunted down like a dog. I am not going to pretend like there's anything else going on.
But, Ryan snapped back,
but nothing. Now, next topic. What's next on the day's agenda?
Arnie Van Dam looked at his boss for a long time. Finally, he nodded.
Why don't we take the afternoon off, Jack? Me and my people will let you and Kathy and the kids have the house to yourself. Rent a movie. Eat a pizza. You deserve it. You've been working your ass off.
Jack calmed himself down. He shook his head.
You've been working harder than me. Sorry I jumped on you.
Lots of stress in a normal campaign. This is not a normal campaign.
No, it's not. I'm fine. Let's get back to work.
Whatever you say, Jack. 54. Jerry Henley lived alone. Since the death of his wife and children in a car accident, he had wrapped himself in his work, continuing on as a senator before leaving public service, and then taking over as the head of the most private spook shop in the world. His work at Henley Associates, on the white side as well as the black side, kept him occupied a good 60 hours a week, and even at home he watched the overseas markets on FBN and Bloomberg to keep his edge for the white side of his work. And he read Global Security and Foreign Affairs and Jane's and The Economist to keep up with happenings that might affect his job overseeing black ops. Jerry had trouble sleeping. Understandable due to the intense pressures of his occupation, as well as the loss he had experienced in his life. Most important, the loss of his family. Though the death of Brian Caruso the year before and the current situation with John Clark also took a personal toll on Henley. Henley coveted sleep. It was a scarce and precious commodity. So when his phone rang in the middle of the night, it filled him with anger even before his wondering about the news to come filled him with dread. It was 3:20 a.m. when his phone rang, rousing him from his rest.
Yeah?
He answered in a gruff and annoyed tone.
Good morning, sir. Nigel Embling calling from Pakistan.
Good morning.
I'm afraid there's a problem.
I'm listening.
Henley sat up in bed. Now the anger disappeared. And the woe appeared.
I have just learned that your man Sam is missing near Miran Shah.
Now Jerry was up and walking toward his office, heading for his desk and his computer.
What do you mean, missing?
The unit of soldiers he was with was attacked by Haqqani network fighters several days ago. There were heavy losses on both sides, I am told. Sam and others were making their escape in a vehicle. My contact, Major Al-Dakur, was in the front. Your man was in the back. It is possible he fell out of the vehicle on the way to safety.
On the surface, that sounded to Jerry Henley like utter bullshit. His first inclination was to think the ISI officer Embling had put up as reliable had double-crossed his man in the field. But he did not have enough data to make that charge just yet, and he certainly needed Embling's help more than ever now, so he was careful to avoid lashing out with any accusations. He'd been a senator just long enough to know how to talk out of both sides of his mouth.
I understand. So there is no word on whether he is dead or alive?
My man went back to the location of the skirmish with three helicopters full of troops. The Haqqani folks had left their fallen where they lay, and several of Al-Darkur's men were there as well. Sam's body was not there. The major thinks it is likely he's been taken by the enemy.
Henley gritted his teeth. He felt that death in battle might well have been an end preferable to Driscoll than whatever the Taliban had in store for him.
What do you suggest I do on my end?
Embling hesitated, then said,
I know very well how this looks. It looks like the Major has not been truthful to us. But I've been at this long enough to know when I'm being played. I trust this young man. He has promised me that he is working to find the location of your men, and he has promised to keep me apprised of the situation several times a day. I ask you to allow me to relay this information to you as I receive it. Perhaps between the three of us, we can come up with something.
Jerry did not see that he had any options. Still, he said,
I want my men to meet this major.
I understand, replied Embling.
They are in Dubai at the moment.
Then we will both come to them. Until we find out how the operation in Miran Shah was compromised, I don't think it is a good idea to send anyone else here.
I agree. You make arrangements and I'll notify my men.
Henley hung up, then called Sam Granger.
Sam, Jerry, we've lost another operator. I want all senior staff in the office in 1 hour.
Riaz Rian's second attack on India came 2 weeks after the first. While his Bangalore attack was bloody, it could be quickly and easily attributed to a single Lashkar-e-Taiba cell. And while LET was undoubtedly a Pakistani terrorist organization, and virtually everyone in the know realized it was, to one degree or another, backed by the beards of Pakistan's ISI, the Bangalore massacre did not scream massive international conspiracy. And that had been by Rian's careful design. To start with a big event that opened the eyes of everyone, but did not put too much direct focus on his organization. It had worked. Arguably, it had worked too well. But Rian had not yet noticed any detrimental effects of the massive body count, such as wholesale arrests of his LET operatives. No, everything was moving according to his plan, and now it was time to begin phase two of that plan. The attackers came by air, land, and sea. By air, 4 Lashkar operatives traveling under forged Indian passports landed at the airport in Delhi, and then met up with a 4-man sleeper cell that had been there for more than a year, waiting to be activated by the ISI handlers in Pakistan. By land, 7 men successfully crossed the border overland into Jammu, and made their way to Jammu city itself, taking residence in a boarding house full of Muslim workers. And by sea, 4 rigid-hulled inflatable boats landed at 2 different locations on the Indian coast, 2 craft in Goa on India's west coast, and 2 in Chennai in the east. Each boat carried 8 terrorists and their equipment, meaning 16 armed men for each location. This put a total of 47 men in 4 different locations across the width of India, and all 47 men had mobile phones with store-bought encryption systems that would slow down India's intelligence and military response to the attacks themselves, though Rian had no doubt the transmissions would eventually be decoded. In Goa, the 16 men split into 8 groups, and each group attacked a different beachside restaurant on Baga and Candolim beaches with hand grenades and Kalashnikov rifles. Before police could kill all of the attackers, 149 diners and restaurant workers were dead. In Jammu, a city of more than 400,000, the 7 men who'd crossed overland from Pakistan broke into 2 teams. At 8 p.m., the teams blew open the emergency exits and movie houses on opposite sides of the city, and then the men, 3 in one location and 4 in the other, ran through the broken doors, stood in front of the movie screens, and opened fire on the huge Friday night theater crowds. 43 Indians lost their lives at one theater, 29 at the other. Between the 2 locations, more than 200 people were injured. In the massive coastal city of Chennai, the 16 terrorists attacked an international cricket tournament. Security for the tournament had been beefed up after the Bangalore attack, and this undoubtedly saved hundreds of lives. The 16 terrorists were wiped out after killing 22 civilians and police and injuring just under 60. In Delhi, the 8-man cell entered the Sheraton New Delhi Hotel in the Saket District Center, killed the security guards in the lobby, and then split into 2 groups. 4 used the stairs to begin going floor to floor, room to room, to shoot anyone they encountered. The other 4 burst into a banquet hall and sprayed automatic fire on a wedding reception. 83 innocents were killed before the 8 LET operatives were hunted down by the Rapid Action Force of the Indian Central Reserve Police Force. The project manager of the entire assault had been Riaz Rihan. He and his top men worked out of a safe house in Karachi, used voice-over internet phones attached to encrypted computers in order to stay in touch with the teams of men to help them maximize the lethality of their actions. 3 times during the evening, Rihan, known to the terrorists in India as Mansoor, prayed with individual cell members before the men stormed into the guns of police. He had explained to all 47 Lashkar men that the entire operation, the entire future of Pakistan, hinged on them not being taken alive. All 47 did as they were told. Riaz Rian had deliberately crafted this operation so that it would appear incredibly intricate and over the heads of the leadership of Lashkar, as he wanted the Indians to see evidence of a Pakistani conspiracy against them. This worked as he knew it would, and by daylight on October 30th, the Indian government had ordered its military at full alert. Indian Prime Minister Priyanka Pandyan and Pakistani President Harun Zahid both spent the morning huddled with their military leaders and cabinet ministers, and by noon, Pakistan had heightened the readiness of its own military in case India took advantage of the confusion of the attacks to reach over the border in retaliation. Riaz Rehan could not have been more pleased with how events unfolded, because Operation Saker had required such a response to go forward. Once the India attacks were complete, Rehan and his officers and staff headed to Dubai to avoid the scrutiny of the factions of the non-Islamists in the ISI. 55. The United Arab Emirates was a nation based on commerce and capitalism, but it also possessed a black core of powerful Islamists, men of a darker age. Where these two phenomena met, where ancient religious barbarity and cold hard cash intertwined, was the world of the benefactors of Riaz Rehan. These men also possessed influence in all facets of the government, spies in the corridors of power, informants in every bastion of life in the Emirates. If Rehan sought information about anyone or anything in the UAE, it was his for the asking. Which is how he learned that Major Mohammed Al-Darkour and a British expatriate traveling under a Dutch passport would be landing at Dubai International Airport at 9:36 p.m. Rehan and his contingent of security and plain-clothed ISI officers were due to arrive in Dubai early the following morning, so the Pakistani general assumed Al-Darkour and the English spy were in town to get information on him. Clearly, Al-Darkour's operation in Maran Shah, an op that coincided with his training of the Jama'at Sharia troops at the Haqqani camp, indicated that the young major was investigating Rehan. There was no reason he would show up here now unless it involved some further interest in the JIM directorate. Riaz Rehan was not worried about the major's investigation into him. On the contrary, he saw it as incredibly good fortune that the man and his associate had come to Dubai. Because while confronting the meddlesome major and his foreign ally in Pakistan could have been problematic for the low-profile ISI general, here in Dubai, Riaz Rehan could, quite literally, get away with murder. Embling and Al-Darkour took a private car to their apartment at the incredible Burj Khalifa, the tallest building in the world. They were in town to meet with members of the campus, but for security reasons, Jerry Hendley had forbade his operators from giving either Embling or his suspicious ISI informant any information about where they were staying while in Dubai. So Al-Darkour himself had made arrangements for accommodations. The massive needle-like skyscraper with 163 inhabitable floors and a 43-story spire topping that was a quick and easy place for them to find quarters. Embling and Al-Darkour shared a two-bedroom flat on the 108th floor. Mohammed did not trust most of the ISI any more than did Jerry Hendley. He had used a personal credit card and handled details of the trip on a computer at an internet cafe in Peshawar, lest his own organization get wind of his travel plans. Once settled in at their flat, Embling called a number Hendley had given him. It connected him to the satellite phone of one of the two campus operators he had met the year before in Peshawar, the 40-something-year-old Mexican-American who went by the name Domingo. They made arrangements to meet at Embling's place at the Burj Khalifa as soon as possible. At the same moment Rehan and company's Pakistan International Airlines flight from Islamabad landed at Dubai International Airport, Jack Ryan, Dom Caruso, and Domingo Chavez stood in an elevator in the Burj Khalifa. The elevators at the world's tallest building are, not coincidentally, the world's fastest, and they jetted the three Americans higher into the gargantuan tower at over 45 miles an hour. They were led into the apartment and found themselves in a large, open room with a sunken sitting area in front of floor-to-ceiling views of the Persian Gulf from an altitude nearly that of the top of the Empire State Building. Nigel Embling stood in the modern living room full of dark wood and metal and glass in front of the incredible panoramic view. He was a big Englishman with thin, snow-white hair and a bushy beard. He wore a slightly rumpled blazer over an open-neck button-down shirt and brown slacks. "My dear friend Domingo," said Embling with an air of sympathy, "before we get into the other disaster that has befallen your organization, I must tell you how sorry I am to hear about this affair involving John Clark." Chavez shrugged. "Me too. It will get straightened out. I'm certain of it." "Just don't believe everything you hear," Ding added. Embling waved his hand. "I haven't heard one bloody thing that doesn't sound like just another day at the office for a man in Mr. Clark's profession. I may be old and soft, but I haven't forgotten the way of the world." Chavez just nodded and said, "May I present my associates, Jack and Dominic?" "Mr. Embling," Jack said as he shook the older man's hand. Of course the Englishman recognized the son of the former and presumed future President of the United States, but he gave off no hint of his making the connection. He then walked the three Americans over to the only other inhabitant of the apartment, a physically fit, cinnamon-skinned Pakistani in shirt sleeves and black jeans. They were surprised to learn this was the ISI major. "Mohammed al-Darkur, at your service." The attractive man held out a hand to Chavez, but Chavez did not extend his own. All three of the campus operators held this man personally responsible for the loss of their friend. While Henley had been careful not to tip his hat to Embling that he had his suspicions, Domingo Chavez was not about to play nice to the son of a bitch who likely got his colleague killed in the wilds of Pakistan's lawless tribal region.
"Tell me, Major al-Darkur, why I shouldn't bash your head against the wall."
Al-Darkur was taken aback, but Embling interjected.
"Domingo, please understand. You have little reason to trust him, but I hope you have somewhat more reason to trust me. I have made it my mission in the past months to check the Major out, and he is one of the good guys, I assure you."
Don Caruso addressed the older Englishman.
"Well, I don't know you, and I definitely don't know this asshole, but I know what the ISI has been doing for the past 30 years, so I'm not going to trust this bastard until we get our man back."
Ryan did not get a chance to echo the sentiment before the Pakistani replied.
"I completely understand your point of view, gentlemen. I have come today to ask you to give me just a few days to work with my contacts in the region. If Mr. Sam is being held by the Haqqani Network, I will pull every string I can to either get him released or else get an operation launched to rescue him."
"You were with him when he was taken?" asked Chavez.
"I was indeed. He fought very bravely."
"I heard it was a hell of a fight."
"Many killed on both sides," al-Darkur admitted.
"Can't help but notice that you look none the worse for wear."
"I'm sorry?
Where are you hit? Bullet wounds? Shrapnel?"
Muhammad al-Darkur reddened as his eyes lowered.
"It was a chaotic situation. I was not injured seriously, but men on my left and right died."
Chavez snorted.
"Listen, Major, I don't trust you. My organization doesn't trust you. But we do trust Mr. Embling. We think it's possible that you have managed to charm him somehow. But don't think your trip here is going to charm us. We will respond favorably to results, not promises. If you and your colleagues can find our man, we want that information immediately."
"And you shall have it, I promise. I have people working on that, just as I have men looking into the Haqqani ISI connection."
"Again, results are what impress me."
"Understood. I do have one question, though."
"What's that?"
"I understand you are in Dubai to monitor General Rian. Is the rest of your team monitoring him now?"
There was no rest of Chavez's team, but he did not say this. Instead, he replied,
"Trust me, when he comes to Dubai, we will be on him."
Now, Muhammad al-Darkur's eyebrows rose.
"My information is that he arrived in Dubai this morning. I assumed I would help you translate any conversations he has at his safe house."
Chavez looked at Caruso and Ryan. Their passive monitoring devices were dormant in the air ducts of the Rian compound. If their target was here in Dubai, then they needed to return to the Kempinski and begin the surveillance. Ding nodded slowly.
"We have translators. My team will know it as soon as Rian gets to his place."
Al-Darkur seemed satisfied by this, and soon Chavez left the apartment with Caruso and Ryan. In front of the elevators, Jack said,
"If Rian is here, we could already have missed something important."
Chavez said,
"Yeah. You guys hustle back to the bungalow and get on it. I need to head over to the airport and meet the plane to pick up the equipment. But first I'm going to get Embling away from the Major and debrief him thoroughly. I'll see you guys back at the place in a few hours."
Chavez spent 3 hours in discussions in the 108th floor flat. The first hour was exclusively in a room with Nigel Embling. The British expat spent the vast majority of that time going over everything he had learned about Muhammad al-Darkur in the past month and a half. Embling's other contacts within the PDF had convinced him that neither the 7th Battalion of the Special Services Group, called the Zarar Commandos, with whom al-Darkur was aligned, nor the Joint Intelligence Bureau, to which al-Darkur had been assigned in the ISI, was overrun or heavily influenced by Islamist radicals, as were many sectors of the PDF. Further, al-Darkur's own actions leading an SSG unit against terrorist groups in the Swat Valley and Chitral had won him commendations that would have made him a target of the beards in the PDF. Last, Embling assured Dean Chavez that he himself had been in the room when Sam Driscoll insisted on going along on the Miran Shah operation. Major al-Darkur had been against the Americans' participation and had only reluctantly allowed him to go. It took the full hour, but finally Chavez was convinced. He spent 2 more hours talking to Aldakur about the operation on which Sam disappeared, and he quizzed him on his staff and the contacts he claimed to be shaking down to get information on the missing American's whereabouts. Finally, sometime around noon, Chavez left the men in their apartment and headed to the airport to pick up the sniper rifle and other gear sent in on the Gulfstream. Ryan and Caruso returned to their bungalow at the Kempinski Hotel and Residences and activated their passive surveillance equipment across the water, and all 3 cameras came to life. There was definite activity in the house, though at first none of their cameras revealed Rian to be present. While they waited and watched the feeds from the cameras and listened to various men speaking Urdu stroll through the entry hall and great room, they called Rick Bell. It was just past 2 a.m. in Maryland, but Rick promised that he, a technical analyst, and an Urdu-speaking translator would be on station at Henley Associates within 45 minutes. Ryan and Caruso recorded all received image and audio captures until then, and they fed them on for analysis. It was after 11 a.m. Dubai time, some 2 hours after Dom and Jack arrived back at the bungalow, when a flurry of excitement appeared to take over the guard force in the house. Men tightened their ties and took up positions in the corners of the rooms. More men appeared through the front door carrying luggage, and finally, a big man with a trim beard came through the front door. One by one, he greeted all the guards standing there with a kiss on the cheek and a handshake, and then he and another man, who seemed to be a high-level officer, entered the great room. The men were deep in conversation. Caruso said, "The big guy is Rian. Looks about the same as he did in Cairo back in September. I'll email Bell and let him know you have confirmed Rian. I should have shot that fucker back then." Ryan thought that over. His concerns about Sam and Waziristan and Clark in Europe were eating him up, and he knew it was even worse for his cousin. A year earlier, Dominic's twin brother had been killed in a campus operation in Libya. The thought of losing 2 more operators must have weighed extra heavy on Caruso. "We're going to get Sam back, Dom." Dominic nodded distractedly as he watched the feed. "And Clark will either fix his own situation, or he'll hang out until my dad takes office and Dad will look after him." "There's going to be a lot of pressure on your dad not to get involved," Jack sniffed. "Dad would take a bullet in the chest for John Clark. A few bleeding heart congressmen aren't going to stop him." Dom chuckled, and they discussed it no further. Soon, Dominic called Ryan over from where he had been sitting in the bedroom, peering through the spotting scope at Rian's safe house. "Hey, looks like everyone is heading back out." "Busy fucker, isn't he?" Ryan said as he hustled back in to watch on the monitor. Rian had taken off the suit coat he was wearing, and now he was clad in a simple white shirt and black suit pants. He and the man who was beginning to look like his second in command were standing back in the hall with a group of about 8 men, most of the guard force that had come with them from Pakistan, as well as a couple of faces Ryan recognized as being regulars at the house. The audio was good. Dominic and Ryan could hear every word, but neither man spoke Urdu, so they would have to wait for the translator in West Odenton, Maryland, to translate the conversation in order to put some context to the scene. Seconds later, Rian and an entourage left through the front door.
"Show's over for now, I guess," said Dom. "I'm going to make a sandwich."
20 minutes after Domingo Chavez left Embling and Aldarkur's flat, there was a knock at the door. The Pakistani major was on the phone with his staff in Peshawar, so Embling went to answer it. He knew there was security in the building that would not allow anyone off on this floor of private residences who did not have permission from one of the occupants, so he was not concerned about his security. As he looked through the peephole, he saw a waiter in a white tuxedo jacket holding a wine bucket full of ice and a bottle of champagne. "May I help you?" he asked through the door. Then he mumbled to himself, "By taking that lovely bottle of Dom Perignon off your hands."
"Compliments of property management, sir. Welcome to Dubai."
Embling smiled, opened the door, and then he saw the other men rushing up the hallway. He made to slam the door shut, but the waiter had flung his wine bucket aside, drawn a Steyr automatic pistol, and leveled it at Nigel Embling's forehead. Embling did not move. From around the side of the doorway, hidden from sight from the peephole, General Riaz Rian of Joint Intelligence Miscellaneous appeared. He carried a small automatic pistol himself.
"Indeed, Englishman," he said. "Welcome to Dubai."
9 other men burst into the apartment past Nigel with handguns held high. 56. Caruso had finished his sandwich, and he and Ryan were in the process of powering down the bug-bot surveillance devices in order to save battery power. They would wait until evening to fire them up again, hoping that Rian would be back by then.
The sat phone on the table rang, and Caruso answered it.
Yeah? Dom, it's Bell.
What's up, Rick?
We've got a problem. When we got into the office, we started at the beginning of your transmission of the audio, so we've been about 15 minutes behind on the translations.
Not a problem. Rion took off a little while ago, so we were powering down the...
There is a problem. We just translated what he said before he walked out the door.
Domingo Chavez was stuck in traffic just a quarter mile from the exit to the airport. On his way back from picking up his sniper rifle and ammo from the Henley Associates Gulfstream, he got caught behind a bad traffic accident on the Business Bay Bridge, and now he sat in the BMW, very glad at the moment that the air conditioner was saving him from the brutal heat, because it looked like he'd be going nowhere soon. In front of him, some 3 miles away, he could see the Burj Khalifa reach up into the sky. On the other side of that, all the way over at the coast, was Palm Jumeirah, his destination. Just then, his mobile rang.
Gopher Ding, he said. It was Ryan, his voice rushed and intense.
Rion knows Embling and Aldarkur are at the Burj Khalifa. He's headed there now with a crew of goons.
Shit. Call Nigel.
I did, no answer. Tried the landline to his place too, nobody picked up.
Son of a bitch, Chavez said.
Get over there as fast as possible, I'm stuck in gridlock. We're moving, but it will be 20 minutes at least.
Just haul ass, kid. They're our only link to Sam, we can't lose them.
I know. In the BMW just west of Business Bay Bridge, Domingo Chavez slammed his hands into the steering wheel in frustration.
Damn it!
Both Mohammed Aldarkur and Nigel Embling had been secured with plastic restraints, their hands behind their backs, their ankles zip-tied together. Rion had ordered his men to stand the men up against the floor-to-ceiling windows in the sunken living room, with their backs against the glass. General Rion sat in front of them on the long couch, his legs crossed and his arms back over the cushions. He was a man in his element, comfortable here with prisoners at his mercy. Rion's men, Colonel Khan and an 8-strong security force, stood around the room. Another sentry remained outside in the hallway. They each carried a pistol of their own choosing. Stiers and SIGs and CZs were represented in the force, and Rion and Khan both carried Berettas and shoulder holsters. If Nigel Embling still harbored any faint shred of doubt as to the trustworthiness of ISI Major Mohammed Aldarkur, that doubt was dispelled. Rion's men bashed Aldarkur's face into the glass window multiple times, and the 35-year-old Pakistani shrieked curses at his elder countrymen. Nigel did not need 40 years of in-country experience in Pakistan to recognize that these two Pakistanis did not care for each other. Aldarkur shouted at Rion. He spoke in English.
What did you do with the American in Maran Shah?
The calm general smiled and answered in English.
I met with the man personally.
He did not have much to say. I ordered him tortured for information about your plans. I suppose your future plans are not as important to me now as they were when I gave that order, seeing how you now have no future.
Aldarkur kept his chin high.
Others are on to you. We know you are working with the coup organizers. We know you have trained a foreign force at the Haqqani camp near Miran Shah. Others will come behind me and they will stop you, inshallah.
Ha! Rion laughed. Inshallah? If Allah wills it? Let's see if Allah wills you to succeed, or if he wills me to succeed.
Rion looked to his two guards standing near the prisoners by the window.
It is stuffy in this pretentious apartment. Open a window.
The two guards drew their pistols, turned as one, and fired over and over into a 10-by-10-foot pane of the thick floor-to-ceiling window glass against which the two prisoners stood. It did not shatter immediately, but as the number of holes increased in the pane, from 5 to 10 to 20, white fissures spread between the bullet holes. The men reloaded their handguns, while the cracking and popping of the glass continued, growing in volume until the massive glass square shattered outward, sending razor-sharp shards falling 108 stories down. Warm wind blew into the luxury apartment, some pebble-sized flecks of glass with it, and Rion and his men had to shield their eyes while the dust settled. The whine of the airflow up the side of the building rushing into the open panel in the window forced Rion to stand up from the couch and come nearer to his prisoners to be heard. He looked at Major Aldarkur for a moment, before turning to Nigel Embling, propped against the window glass, hands and legs bound, next to the huge opening to the bright sky.
I've looked into your background. You are from another century, Embling. The expatriate spy of a colonial power that has somehow missed the message that it no longer has any colonies. You are a pathetic man.
You and the other infidels of the West have so long raped the children of Allah that you can no longer understand that your time has passed. But now, old fool, now the caliphate has returned. Can you not see it, Embling? Can you not see how the destruction of British colonialism has so perfectly set the stage for my ascendance to power? Embling shouted at the big Pakistani standing just feet from his face, and spittle flew from his mouth. Your ascendance to power? Your lot are the ones destroying Pakistan. It is good men like the Major here who will lead your country back from the abyss, not monsters like you.
Riaz Rian just waved a hand in the air. Fly home, Englishman. And with that, he gave a curt nod to two ISI security men standing near Nigel Embling. They stepped forward, yanked the big man off balance by his shoulders, and pulled him backward toward the open window. He screamed in horror as they pushed him over the edge, then let him go, and he fell backward, away from the building, tumbling out, head over feet through the hot desert wind, dropping 108 floors toward concrete and steel below. Major Muhammad al-Darkur screamed at Rian,
Kuteka Bacha!
Son of a dog. Though bound hand and foot, he pushed forward off the glass, tried to lunge at the big general. Two security men grabbed him before he fell forward into the apartment, and they wrestled with him, finally pulling him backward toward the 10-by-10-foot hole in the floor-to-ceiling glass. Rian's men looked up to their general for guidance. General Rian just nodded with a slight smile.
Send him to join his English friend.
Al-Darkur cursed and shouted and tried to kick. He shook one of his arms away from the man dragging him to the edge, but another gunman holstered his weapon and rushed forward. Together, three men now fought the major on the ground in the flecks and chips of broken window glass. It took a moment, but they gained control of Al-Darkur. The others in the room stood around laughing as the ISI officer fought with only the movements of his torso. Al-Darkur screamed at Rian,
Mata chat!
Motherfucker! The three guards dragged Major Al-Darkur across the floor, pulled him closer to the edge. Mohammed stopped his fight now. The wind, racing from the desert floor, up 108 stories of hot glass and metal, blew the cinnamon-skinned Pakistani's black hair into his eyes, and he shut them, squinted tight, and began to pray. The three gunmen took him under his shoulders, lifted him up, and grabbed him by his belt as well. As one, they heaved his body back, ready to launch him forward toward the sun. But they did not move forward as one. The security officer holding Al-Darkur's left shoulder lurched away from the window and spun around. He dropped the major and, in so doing, caused the other two to lose their grip. Before anyone in the room could react, a second man at the window's ledge moved away from the bound major. This man fell backward into the apartment, rocked back on his heels, and tumbled down into the sunken seating area by the sofa. Rian turned to look at the man, to see what the hell he was doing. But instead, his eyes looked past his guard and toward the cream-colored leather sofa that was now covered in a crimson splatter of blood. Rian looked back out the window. In the distance, he saw a black speck in the sky a few hundred feet over the Burj Al Arab Hotel in the distance. A helicopter? 1 second later, just as the last man holding Al-Darkur let go of the major and grabbed his bloody leg while falling to the floor, General Riaz Rian shouted to the room,
Sniper!
Colonel Khan leapt over the sofa and tackled Rian to the tile just as a hot rifle round raced past the general's forehead. 57.
Get me closer, Hicks! Domingo Chavez shouted into the boom mic of the headset as he slammed a second five-round magazine into the magazine well of his HK PSG-1 sniper rifle. He'd missed with his last two shots, he was certain, and only by getting closer could he nail Rian and his men, as they were now running and crawling and scrambling for cover.
Roger that, Hicks said in a calm Kentucky drawl, and the Bell Jet Ranger raced nearer to the massive spire-like structure.
Even with the broken window pane in Al-Darkur and Embling's place, Chavez would never have been able to identify the location of their apartment had he not also been able to catch a glimpse through his 12-power scope of something tumbling out of the side of the building, spiraling down toward the ground. It was a man. Ding knew this instinctively, though he could not take the time to try to identify who was plunging before him to their death. Instead, Chavez had to range his weapon for 500 meters and do his best to line a target up in his mil-dot crosshairs. Even though Chavez had not spent much range time working on sniper craft in the past year, he still felt comfortable making a 500-meter shot under the right conditions. But the helicopter's vibrations, the downwash of the rotors, the upward movements of the air currents along the skyscraper, all had to be solved for in order to make a precision hit.
so Chavez did not go for precision. He did his best to calculate everything he could to the best of his ability, and then he lined up for a gut shot. Center mass on his targets. A man's stomach was not the perfect location for a sniper shot. No, perfect would have been the brain pan. But targeting the upper stomach gave him the greatest margin of error, and he knew there would be some errors in his targeting, considering everything he had to deal with. He fired from the back seat of the chopper, propping his weapon in the open window. This would absolutely destroy the carefully tuned barrel harmonics of his rifle, but again, getting closer would fix everything.
"Closer, brother!"
"You worry about your gadget, let me worry about mine," replied Hicks. To say the call from Chavez to the aircraft 20 minutes earlier had come as a surprise to Chester Hicks was putting it mildly. He had been going through some paperwork with Adara Sherman when his mobile rang. "Hello?"
"Country, I'm on my way back. I need you to scare me up a helicopter in 10 minutes. Can you do that?"
"You bet. There's a charter service right here at the FBO. Where should I tell them you were heading?"
"I need you to fly it, and we will likely be heading into combat."
"You're kidding, right?"
"This is life and death shit, Mono."
A quick pause. "Then get your ass back here. I'll grab us an aircraft." Hicks had been all action after that. He and Adara Sherman jogged across the tarmac to a dormant jet ranger that belonged to a resort hotel 20 miles up the coast. There were many newer and fancier helos on the tarmac, but Hicks had flown the jet ranger. He'd trained on Bell helos, and Hicks figured the most important factor on this hasty mission ahead of him would be the skill of the pilot, and not the most advanced technology. After looking the craft over for just a few seconds, he sent Sherman to the FBO to collect the keys by any means necessary. He removed the tie-downs and checked the fuel and the oil while she was gone. And even before he sat behind the cyclic, Sherman was back, tossing him the keys.
"Do I want to know what you did?"
"Nobody home. I probably could have snagged some Sheik's Boeing widebody if I wanted it." Chavez arrived 5 minutes later, and they were in the air as soon as he strapped in. While Chavez loaded his sniper rifle, Hicks asked over the intercom,
"Where are we going?"
"The tallest building in the world. Doubt you can miss it."
"Roger that."
He turned the nose of the jet ranger toward the Burj Khalifa and increased his rate of climb and his ground speed. Rian and Khan crawled across the tile floor of the apartment toward the door to the hallway. The colonel kept his body positioned between the shooter and the helicopter and his general as they scrambled, until another protection officer slid over next to them both and then covered General Rian. Just as Rian entered the hallway and rolled out of the line of fire from the helicopter outside, one of his security men grabbed him by the collar and pushed him forward to the elevator. This guard was nearly as big as Rian himself, a hulking 6-foot-3-inch-tall bruiser in a black suit and carrying a big HK pistol. He banged on the down button with his fist, turned to make sure Rian and Khan were still with him, and then turned back as the doors slid open. Rian and Caruso were surprised by the size of the armed Pakistani who appeared right in front of them in the hallway, but they were ready for trouble. Both men held their pistols high. They dropped to their knees as one as the ISI security man's eyes widened. The Pakistani lifted his own gun up into action, but both campus operators fired into the broad chest of their target at no more than 6 feet. The guard did not fall away from them. Instead, he lunged forward into the elevator car. Both men fired a second and then a third time, stitching 9mm rounds across his upper torso. But the ISI officer crashed into Jack Jr., pinned him in the corner, and headbutted the American with all the strength remaining in his body. He fired his HK pistol, but his arm had drooped low and the round went through Ryan's pants, just above the knee, somehow missing his leg. More ISI men in the hallway fired into the elevator now. Rian was pinned by the dead man, but Caruso had dropped low to the floor and was engaging targets. He caught a half glimpse of General Rian running away, up the hall in the opposite direction of Embling's apartment, but he had to focus on the men shooting at him and Jack. He shot another of the general security detail, hitting the man in the lower abdomen, and with another 3-round volley, he chased the remaining men out of his line of fire, sending them up the hallway where they disappeared into the stairwell near Embling's flat. Rian had already headed into the stairwell, presumably to another floor to take an elevator down.
"Get this big motherfucker off me!" Rian shouted.
Dom helped roll the dead man over, and immediately he saw blood on Jack's face.
"Are you hit?"
Jack ignored the crack he had taken to his right eye and instead reached down to his leg. He'd felt a round brush him there as it passed a fraction of an inch from his knee. He found the hole in his pants, reached inside it, and felt around for blood. When his fingers came back clean, he said,
"I'm good. Let's go."
and they took off toward Emling's apartment, afraid of what they might find. Inside, Dominic and Jack ran to Aldarkur. The Pakistani major was having no luck trying to cut his cuffs off with a small piece of glass. Caruso pulled out a folding knife and made short work of the plastic restraints, and he and Ryan helped Muhammad up to his feet.
"Where is Emling?"
Ryan had to shout it over the ringing in his ears after the gunfire in the hallway. Aldarkur shook his head.
"Rian killed him."
That sank in for just a moment before Caruso grabbed Aldarkur by the arm and said,
"You are coming with us."
"Of course." Dom waved to the chopper, and Hicks peeled his borrowed helo away, heading off with Chavez in the back seat. Alarms sounded in the hallway here on the 108th floor, but the elevators were still in service. Muhammad, Jack, and Dom had no doubt there would be police in the elevators by now, but no one could have ascended more than a couple dozen floors of stairs since the shooting started, so all three ran to the stairwell and began heading down. They descended 18 flights in 3 minutes of frantic running and leaping. Once down to the 90th floor, they boarded an elevator with a few Middle Eastern businessmen who were slow to evacuate, complaining they had not smelled smoke and doubted there was any real fire. But Aldarkur's bruised face, Ryan's bloody eye and nose, and the sopping sweat on the faces of all three of the men shocked the Middle Easterners. When one of the men lifted his camera phone to take a photo of Aldarkur, Dom Caruso snatched the device from the man's hand. Another made to shove Dom back, but Ryan drew his pistol and waved the men back against the wall. As the elevator dropped at 45 miles an hour, the Pakistani major and the two American operatives pulled the phones from all three men, stomped them with their heels, and then stopped the carriage on the 10th floor. Here they ordered the men off, and then hit the button for the lower of two basement parking garages. 15 minutes later, they walked out of the parking exit and into the sunlight. There, the three men melted in with the crowd. They passed police and firefighters and other first responders rushing into the building, and headed out into the hot afternoon streets to find a taxi. While Jack, Dom, and Aldarkur raced to the airport, Chavez had Hicks drop him off in a parking lot near the beach. Hicks returned alone to the airport, and Ding took a taxi back to the Kempinski to break down all the surveillance equipment in the bungalow. Their operation against Rian here in Dubai was compromised, and that was putting it mildly. There would be no way the three men could go back to the bungalow and wait for Rian to return. The heat would be turned up too high after the massive shootout. There would be bodies on the evening news in a city that did not have much in the way of crime, and the comings and goings of all foreigners would face tighter scrutiny. Ding had instructed Hicks to call Captain Reed and have the Gulfstream ready to go ASAP, but Chavez wouldn't be on it himself. He'd need a few hours to clean up all traces of their activities at the Kempinski, and he'd just have to find another way out of the country after that. Hicks landed the chopper right where he'd picked it up, then met Sherman at the bottom of the stairs to the Gulfstream. She'd given the man working the desk at the FBO 10,000 euros when he'd come looking for the missing helicopter, and she felt reasonably certain he'd keep his mouth shut until they were wheels up. Once Jack, Dom, and Muhammad arrived in their taxi, they boarded the plane, and Helen Reed called the tower to let them know they were ready to execute their flight plan. Their customs departure had been taken care of by Ms. Sherman with the help of another 10,000 euros. They flew Muhammad Aldarkur to Istanbul. He would make his own way back to Peshawar. They all agreed it would be dangerous for him to return to his home country. If Rian was willing to take a step as big as his Dubai attack, there was no question he would work to have Aldarkur killed as soon as the major returned. But Muhammad assured the Americans he knew a place where he could lie low, away from the elements of the ISI that were plotting against the civilian leadership. He also promised them he would find where Sam Driscoll was being kept and report back as soon as possible. 58. 4 days after returning from Dubai, Jack Ryan Jr. had an appointment that he could not cancel. It was November 6th, Election Day, and Jack headed up to Baltimore in the late morning to be with his family. Jack Ryan Sr. headed down to his local polling place in the morning with Kathy, surrounded by reporters. After that, he returned home to spend the day with his family, with plans to head down to the Marriott waterfront to give his acceptance speech that evening, or his concession speech, depending on the results in a few key battleground states. The Clark controversy had hurt him. There was no denying this. Every show from 60 Minutes to Entertainment Tonight had found an angle on the story, and every talking head on the news had something to say about it. Ryan took the high road throughout the last few weeks of his campaign. He'd made his statements regarding his friend, and he'd done his best to frame the story as a political attack on him, Jack Ryan, and not honest justice. This worked with his base, and it swayed some undecided.
But the unanswered questions as to the actual relationship between Jack Ryan and the mysterious man on the run from the government tipped many undecided toward Edward Keelty. The media framed the Ryan-Clark relationship as if the latter were the personal assassin for the former. And whatever one could say about